You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
I don't know how many of you saw the New York Times today, but the facts were pretty extraordinary. They mentioned that more journalists have been killed in connection to their work in the first 9 months of 2018 than in all of 2017. This year, the United States has the third highest number of journalists killed worldwide. So far this year, at least 43 journalists, and I was hearing that maybe 47 today, have been killed around the world as a result of their work. And that's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, whose executive director, Joel Simon, is with us this evening. I'm very impressed by something that happened this afternoon. These two gentlemen you're about to meet went and spent the afternoon with a group of teenagers at the Benjamin Franklin branch in Boyle Heights. And they were a group of young boys and girls, mostly between the ages of about 13 and 16 or 17, including a few younger who were very impressive. And they talked to them about the role of a journalist at this moment in our society. And Gerald Ryle, who was one of these gentlemen, is the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ. He is one of the incredibly forceful parts of the worldwide team that worked on the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers investigations, the biggest in journalism history. Reporters Without Borders has described Gerard Ryle's work as the future of investigative journalism worldwide and named him one of 100 information heroes. Before joining the ICIJ, he was the first non-American director in September 2011. Ryle spent more than 20 years as an investigative reporter and editor in Australia. How he got to Australia is a wonderful story that involves his older brother. You might want to ask him. His work as a journalist began in his native Ireland, and he's the well-known author and TED speaker, and he has won or shared in more than 50 journalism awards in seven different countries, including the 2017 Pulitzer Prize. I'm delighted to say that he is on the stage this evening with a colleague and someone who he knows well and respects, who has been the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ, since 2006. And that's Joel Simon. He's led the organization through a period of expansion and helped to launch their global campaign against impunity. I looked up impunity. I mean, we sort of know what it means. We know what it means. But when I looked it up, I really understood what Joel's about. He's the head of launched the global campaign against impunity, which is exemption from punishment or freedom from the injurious consequences of an action. And he is spearheading the CPJ's defense of press freedom in the digital space. Joel Simon has participated in CPJ missions around the world, from Argentina to Zimbabwe. He's written widely on press freedom issues, leading publications of the day, a regular columnist for the Columbia Journalism Review, the author of three books, which I strongly recommend to you, Endangered Mexico, The New Censorship, and if you can get your hands on the new book, which is coming out in 2019, although I hear there are copies, someone saw a copy today. The title is We Want to Negotiate, Inside the Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages and Ransom. And I'm publicly inviting Joel to come back and to be a part of Aloud with this new book, because it's extraordinary. And what I've been hearing about it is something that we all want to know about. So they're joined by someone whose voice is very familiar to you, because of this is Alex Cohn. She's been on KPCC, and in 2009 was the host of All Things Considered. In 2012, she became the co-host of Take Two, and then last year began hosting Morning Edition. She's won many awards for her work at KPCC. She was named the best anchor in Los Angeles by the Los Angeles Press Club, by her peers. And Alex has joined Spectrum News as one of the morning anchors and to host a primetime evening public affairs program, which we all want to know more about. Please ask her, because we may be the first ones. It's been a bit of a secret, I'm told. But if we can get her to tell us tonight, I think she could be persuaded to do so. My mother says that my idea of keeping a secret is telling one person at a time. So but we're all in it together here. We're all library lovers. Alex is the mother of two, and she I always love, I have to say this. She's a roller derby queen, and she skates under the two names. Her first name is good, Axles of Evil, I get it. But the next name is fantastic, and she skates under the name Smother Teresa. She's the best. So with great pleasure and with great honor, I welcome Alex and Joel and Gerard to the stage. Please come on.
As a journalist, I do have to make one correction to what Ken said. Thank you so much for the kind introduction. I am a former roller derby skater because I do want to be able to walk by the time I hit 60. And I may have been tough enough to roller skate, but I will confess I was never tough enough to do what was initially my dream as an aspiring journalist, which was to be an international reporter. And I am not embarrassed to say that I was, frankly, too scared. My mom was too scared that if I wound up reporting overseas, that something could happen to me. And as headlines are bearing out at this very moment, and as the two of you know very well, there are a lot of statistics to back that up. And we'll delve into the numbers a bit more in a few moments. But I'd love to begin by, I think everyone here probably has a good sense of what journalists do for a living. We find out about stories, and we go talk to people, and we write them up, or we make documentaries about them, or we talk about them on the radio. I'd love to hear a bit more about what each of you do and your organizations do on a given day. Joel, let's start with you.
Well, there's no normal day at CPJ. We're an organization of journalists, and what we do is use the tools of journalism to defend the rights of our colleagues around the world, and we have a team of international experts. We have people all over the world in places where journalists are under threat. And we have something similar to what is like a morning news meeting. So if you've worked in a news organization, you know, all the editors of the different sections will gather in the morning and they'll discuss what the news is and what they're going to cover. We have something similar, except we're talking about, well, car bomb went off in Afghanistan, 3 journalists were killed there, and there's a new law coming down the, that's being proposed in this country. And then we're trying to think about how do we marshal the skills that we have as journalists to draw attention to these violations, to put pressure on the people who are committing the violations, to support journalists who may have been injured or need to evacuate. And so basically that's like a typical day. We start in that morning meeting and we figure out where the events have occurred in the last 24 hours, and then we figure out what can we do, and we sort of deploy, and that's a typical day.
Like the ICIJ, we're a small little nonprofit. We're based in Washington, D.C., but we have reporters around the world. We have people in about 7 different countries. And I guess the best way to describe us is that we find what we think is a really great global story, and we approach media organizations like the New York Times, the Guardian, the BBC, right through to small nonprofits like ourselves around the world. And we do the opposite of everything that an investigative journalist would normally do. Like investigative reporting is usually a lone wolf enterprise. You don't really tell your editors, you know, what you have as a story, because as soon as you tell an editor, the editor wants that story right away. We basically find a story and then we share it with all these journalists around the world and these news organizations, and we expect them in return to give us their reporters to work with us. And we're pioneering ways of doing journalism in a different way, but by using technology. So half of my team, and it's a pretty small team, are computer programmers and data journalists. And we find big data sets, ideally, because big data sets have unique information from each country. And we bring these data sets to the organizations, and then they in turn give us their resources, their reporters, their photographers, and graphic artists. And then we work in secret, usually, for a year or whatever, how long it takes. And we all publish together on the same day. We're probably best known for the Panama Papers, which was a culmination of about 7 years' work that we did over 1 year. But it was a topic that we picked, and we kept picking at it and picking at it and picking at it until someone gave us 11.5 million documents. And then we shared those documents and we published a story together.
And I love it how you just say so modestly something you might have heard of, the Panama Papers. I think a number of people here will be more than familiar with that. I know that we could easily spend all night talking just about that project itself, and we do have other topics to talk about. But could you talk a little bit of it and take us behind the scenes of that investigation, which really was extraordinary?
Yeah, we'd been looking at offshore. You know, people think of offshore and they think of avoiding taxes, but for us it's really about secrecy, and it's about a certain number of people living by different rules, the rules that you and I live by. It really began when I first came to America. I actually joined the ICIJ in 2011. And when I joined, I actually brought a data set with me, a data set I had acquired in Australia from writing a book about a major fraud. And someone came forward with information about the fraud, but it also had all this other information around the world. And that was our first real story, published in 2013. And we had about 40 media organizations that joined that investigation. One of them was a German newspaper called Süddeutsche Zeitung, and we probably never heard of it before, but it's a big Munich newspaper. And then over the course of 3 or 4 years, we published other stories to do with the same theme, and Süddeutsche Zeitung joined those investigations. In 2015, somebody contacted a guy called John Doe, he's an anonymous person, contacted Süddeutsche Zeitung, and said he had information about a Panama law firm called Mossack Fonseca. And this was a pretty notorious law firm. At that point, we were pretty familiar with that world. You know, their clients were Mugabe and Gaddafi and other people. So we were pretty interested in the firm, and we'd be looking at it. And the journalist who got the contacted by John Doe basically over a period of a year managed to get every record of Mossack Fonseca for 40 years. So we're talking about 11.5 million, you know, every client file, every email, every correspondence that this firm had over 40 years. So it was 11.5 million secrets. And they approached, because we had worked with them a few times before, they approached us and they said, how about turning this into a global collaboration? And of course, you know, you're not going to say no to something like that. So I went around the world. I went first to the Guardian and the BBC, signed them up for it. Because when you have big organizations, it's easier to sign up others. And then we just kept going. And then as the documents kind of unfolded in front of us, we then reached out to new countries. You know, we had the, quite famously in the end, the Prime Minister of Iceland in the documents. And we didn't know anyone from Iceland, so we had to be very careful who we chose in that country because it was quite small. So we went to our Swedish collaborators, the ones that we'd worked with a few times before, and they recommended this guy. And he basically dropped out of life for 9 months while he was working on this. He lived on the earnings of his wife, and he basically was able to go through these documents and fill out the information we needed to make a great story. Because even though we had the Prime Minister from day one, we didn't have the context around why he was in these documents. And it took a lot of investigative work before we found that, in fact, this offshore company was secretly owning shares in banks in Iceland. And the Prime Minister had been elected to sort out the financial mess caused by the collapse of the banks. So, of course, it became a very important story. I make that point because when you're looking at documents like this, you've got to find something that's in the public interest. You can't just write a story. You've got to put proper context around it.
I have to say, as a journalist, I hear that and my heart starts to pitter-patter. And I think that's what I want to do, right? You want to be able to reveal great truths. You want to be able to dig into this great story and share that story with the world. That's the glamorous side. There is, of course, an incredible amount of hard work and also, as we're seeing in many of these instances, an incredible amount of danger and challenges. Joel, can you kind of give us an umbrella view of some of the dangers that journalists throughout the world are currently facing?
I think the starting point is to recognize that this is within the information age. Information is power in this particular moment. Who controls information controls power. And so there's a power struggle over information, and journalists are at the heart of that, and they're often on the losing side because they're arrayed against powerful forces that could include drug cartels and terrorist groups and powerful governments. And if you look at the data, you know, one of the things CPJ is known for is we've been collecting detailed data since 1992 on journalists killed around the world, journalists imprisoned around the world. And the last 2 years, we've seen record numbers of journalists imprisoned around the world, 262 journalists imprisoned worldwide. That's the highest number we've ever recorded. You know, we've seen a steady increase in the number of journalists imprisoned going back to 2001. At that point, the framework, the new framework for repression, was the war on terror. We saw governments around the world sort of adopt that rhetoric to justify sweeping repressive action against journalists who they claimed were reporting on terrorism or somehow sympathetic to terrorists. More recently, we've seen a new framework for repression, which is publishing fake news or false news. That's the new framework. We've seen the number of journalists in prison around the world on those charges more than doubled since President Trump took office, which is not a coincidence. And then there's violence. We've seen the kind of framework of violence is a little more complex. When there's conflict and journalists cover in conflict, we see spikes in journalists' deaths, particularly with the conflict in Syria, was the most deadly conflict we've ever recorded for the press. That conflict has faded somewhat, but what we're seeing now are more targeted murders.
It's a really important differentiation, yes, because, that, you know, as we heard Ken say in the introduction, there's the number killed and then there's the number murdered.
Correct.
Can you talk
Correct.
A bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, journalists, you know, there are circumstances in which being a journalist is simply dangerous. You can be out covering a conflict and there's fighting going on and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. There are street demonstrations and riots and protests, and sometimes you get caught up in the middle of that. But actually, most journalists who are killed around the world are targeted and murdered. They're singled out. I think there's a lot of awareness about the risk that journalists face because of this horrific incident we're seeing, we've seen in the last few days involving Washington Post opinion writer named Jamal Khashoggi. He's a Saudi journalist who was a well-known figure in Saudi Arabia, a journalist there, but also somebody who was sympathetic to the monarchy. But he became increasingly critical and eventually left Saudi Arabia, settled in the United States, became a columnist, as I mentioned, for the Washington Post, and then he actually became involved with a Turkish woman. They had become engaged, they wanted to be married, and he had to go get a paper from the Saudi embassy in Istanbul to demonstrate that he had been divorced and could remarry. And apparently the Saudis set a trap for him. There's evidence now that they knew he was going to come to the embassy, and they brought in a team of 15 assassins, basically. They were waiting for him at the consulate. It appears there's more and more evidence every day that he was executed in that consulate and that he was dismembered. His body was smuggled out. But there isn't conclusive proof at this point, but it's an unbelievably striking story and evidence of just how vulnerable journalists are, because this is the most brazen, unconscionable attack that I can remember on a journalist. And the question is, you know, how will the world respond to this terrible incident?
George, you want to weigh in on the Khashoggi story, which is really... and just the last I saw of it, because this, we should just note, this is a developing story, and these are still allegations at this point, but I just read on the way in that apparently the Washington Post has received an audio recording, yes, confirming that, in fact, he was killed.
Yeah, no, it says we also, during the Panama Papers, of course, we ourselves were in the midst of a big tragedy almost a year ago, where the mother of one of my staff members, Daphne Caruana Gazilia, was blown up in Malta. And she was actually investigating the Panama Papers. She wasn't working with us, but she was doing more work around it. She was going, using the information we were publishing and getting her own sources and bringing our stories further forward. The allegation she was making at the time was that the Prime Minister's wife was actually linked to one of the firms that we were going. And then she was with Matthew. Matthew, her son, was the computer programmer who was making the documents available for all the journalists around the world. So he was the genius who basically used open source software to allow us to do this kind of work, because we were pretty much working on a shoestring. And they were together in the house, and his mother left in the car, and then a few minutes later he heard this explosion, went out, and he was the one who found his mother blown to pieces in a field in Malta. And that was almost a year ago. And I think there's been four deaths this year, or certainly in Europe. Now, normally you think of Europe and you think it is not the place you think that journalists get killed. But we had another reporter, again, 6 months ago, Jan Kuciak in Slovakia, who, again, was indirectly linked to the Panama Papers, who was also killed. But maybe you're much better qualified to talk about.
Yeah, but I mean, I think one of the things that's so alarming is you mentioned these killings in Europe. Obviously, this murder that took place in Istanbul, it appears more and more likely. There's more and more evidence that it did in fact occur. There was a journalist murdered in Bulgaria, murdered and raped. It's inconclusive about whether that was related to her work or not, but it certainly caused widespread consternation. And the other thing is, I mean, a different dynamic, but it's just worth mentioning that four journalists have been killed in the United States this year. Some of you may recall there was a horrific incident at a newspaper in suburban Maryland, the Capital Gazette. A disgruntled reader who had sort of been stalking the paper for years burst into the newsroom with a weapon, shot four journalists and a media worker. It's hard to fit this precisely into a global dynamic, but it is worth mentioning that because of this killing, these killings, the U.S. is one of the most deadly countries for journalists in the world this year, behind Afghanistan, Syria, and basically tied with Mexico. So the U.S. has this year, you can suggest it's anomalous, but it's certainly alarming. And then with the killings of journalists in Europe, I think the message here is, nowhere is safe.
I want to follow up on so much of what you both have said, but going back to the notion of fake news and just the political climate in this country right now and how that is reverberating around the world, how is that affecting the situation of journalist safety or lack thereof?
Yeah, I can take that first, and I know you have something to say on this. For U.S. journalists covering Trump, it's a very complicated, somewhat of a mixed bag. Journalists in Washington sometimes say that, it's better, in some ways it's easier to cover Trump than cover Obama, because Obama was an incredible control freak and a pretty effective manager, and he really sealed up a lot of the leaks in Washington, and it was very frustrating. He did a big end run around the media. He would sort of not necessarily engage with the media. Maybe if he had a message, he would go on Jon Stewart or Between Two Ferns. He also, the Obama administration, the Justice Department initiated a number of very aggressive leak investigations that actually ensnared journalists. So covering Obama was no picnic. Meanwhile, covering Trump, of course, he insults journalists all day long and calls them enemy of the people and fake news, but he's obsessed with the media. All he does is watch TV. So you're relevant. At least you got that going for you. It's kind of a mixed bag to cover Trump and be, journalists certainly don't like being vilified and attacked and mocked and undermined, and it's having a terrible impact that we could talk about.
And occasionally physically threatened, too.
Well, and occasionally physically threatened, more than occasionally. So I want to get into that. So, I mean, there is a lot of online threats. There's this troll army that Trump unleashes when he goes after journalists, and that's definitely very alarming. But really where the impact is outside the borders of the United States. That is where this kind of rhetoric is so destructive, because we're seeing governments around the world, they basically make the argument, well, you complain about fake news, but we're actually doing something about it. We're passing laws criminalizing it. We're putting journalists in jail if they publish what we deem to be fake news. Egypt is a terrible abuser in this regard. Turkey as well. There's a whole raft of new fake news laws. And I would even circle back and link this to the Khashoggi killing. I don't want to make a direct to directly link it, but I think there is an environment in which a U.S. ally, a country over which the U.S. has significant influence, obviously made a calculation that they could carry out this heinous crime, and that they wouldn't have to pay a significant price. And God, I hope they're wrong, because that is then it's just open season.
Yeah, I mean, I won't go too long on this, but I do think that Trump has created an environment where it's okay to question, to attack journalists and to dismiss some of the work that we're doing. I mean, we would argue at ICIJ that some of the best ways to tackle this and to counter it is actually to do what we're doing, which is where we're all getting together. It's very hard to counter 400 journalists all looking at the same set of documents and coming to the same conclusions. How can you dismiss that as fake news? And I think if journalists are going to combat this, they've got to do it on a local level. We've got to get together. You know, if someone is refusing to answer questions, we've all got to stand together. I do think, too, we've also got to question ourselves and say, well, how do we long-term, how do we fight this? And I think the best way to fight it is to do better work. And I think that this, you know, while Trump has been terrible in almost all respects, he's also brought the idea of journalism and the need for journalism into sharp focus. And I think that's, you know, that has been the good thing. You know, people are now respecting the fact that good journalism is worth doing. And I think we have now got to ask ourselves as a profession, what can we do now to counter this? And I think the best way to counter it is to do better journalism and to do more of it.
Is there a bit, though, of a blurring of the lines? The expression fake news means such different things to such different people. I mean, back in the day, for me at least, fake news meant the picture of Bat Boy on the cover of the National Enquirer and was kind of quaint. It is lobbed in both directions so heartily now that is there any concern that it's almost lost some sense of meaning?
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I mean, it's always been around. I remember even in Australia where I worked for years, I had a magazine that was selling very well called Truth. And it was actually completely made up. I mean, you know, I remember seeing a cover of Kylie Minogue, the singer, and basically it was all the reasons why Kylie Minogue is an alien. And, you know, and it was based on her body parts, and you can imagine which body parts they were focusing in on. There's that kind of magazine. So it's always been around with us, but I think it's because of the era of the internet, and I think it's because there's so many different ways of getting news now, and the traditional media has, you know, the business model that sustained reporting is kind of broken, and journalism hasn't quite found a way to replace that yet. And, you know, I think that's the kind of era we're going through.
Yeah, I mean, the craziest thing about, you know, the whole fake news is that Trump claims he invented the term, which is fake, false. He didn't invent it. So that's sort of a kind of, you know, it's a sort of doubles in on itself. I mean, fake news is absolutely, Trump has successfully appropriated the term, which is why, you know, the only context in which I use it is talking about how other governments are taking advantage of this framework. It's meaningless. I mean, when he uses fake news, he means this term to mean news that he disagrees with or that's critical of him. You know, what the broader framework in which sometimes when people use this term, what they're talking about is misinformation. So deliberate information that's deliberately false. Sometimes that's published for commercial purposes. Disinformation, which is essentially government propaganda, incorrect news, sloppy reporting. There's a whole range of different kinds of things that people refer to as fake news, but it's all a big jumble. And unless you actually differentiate and specify what you're actually talking about, you're really just empowering Trump to use this term as a way of sort of debasing and vilifying the press.
I want to go back to another case that you just brought up, Joel, of the Bulgarian journalist Victoria Marinova, who we don't know the exact cause, but we do know that she was raped and murdered. Can you both talk a little bit about the specific challenges and dangers that are currently facing women journalists?
You know, when you talk to women journalists who work in high-risk environments, the first thing they talk about is the vitriol and the threats that they receive online. And they're always sexualized. Those threats are always specifically sexualized. And there is an absolute pile-on process that can be incredibly intimidating. It can just sort of, it's hard to explain what it feels like to go through that. And this is a global phenomenon. There's been some attention on this in the United States, and there are ways that governments can manipulate these, you know, these online attacks, and they can really be debilitating. And then there's sexualized violence in the real world. We did a sort of groundbreaking report on this about a decade ago, and it's something that many journalists who've been victimized don't want to talk about. So it was a very difficult process to get journalists who'd experienced these kinds of sexualized attacks to share their experience and create a level of awareness, and it's led to some positive changes, like more like newsrooms are more attuned to these kinds of challenges and are addressing them more regularly. But it's still a phenomenon that I believe is much more widespread than people realize, and it's a specific challenge that women journalists face. You know, now honestly, they face them in every single environment. I mean, like I was talking to somebody who was a CNN person who used to do social media, and she just was telling me that she was having conversations with Facebook and saying the environment, because they would do these kind of online broadcasts where they would invite people in, and she was saying the online environment that my journalists have to operate in, it's unsafe on Facebook. It's unsafe. Because they're just being piled on and attacked, so there are myriad challenges, but it's definitely a difficult moment.
Yeah, I think women have always found, I think journalism has always been a challenge because until quite recently, it was always dominated by men. You know, when I first joined ICIJ, it was a network of about 100 investigative reporters around the world, and there were about 5 women. You know, we've changed that, and we're trying to change that. That's the upside here is that it is changing, and women are coming into the profession more, and they're coming into the what was considered the sort of the non-female part, which is investigative reporting. And we're now largely, I would say, driven by women because they're doing some of the best reporting. So there is a good side.
Nice to hear a little bit of good news in all of this. And in a little bit, we will turn to members of the audience to ask your questions of either or both of our guests. But I do want to talk a bit on that positive note about what can be done. And when you hear some of these numbers and you hear what's happening in the world, and it's very hard not to feel quite bleak about it all, what can and should be done by newsrooms, publications, and by the general public?
Well, I mean, one reason that you're seeing this, you know, levels of violence and repression is because independent information is such a threat to people in power. And, you know, there are some places around the world that are completely controlled and censored where journalists, you don't have any journalists in prison and you don't have any journalists killed because there's no independent reporting. You know, North Korea comes to mind. So, you know, to a certain extent, when you're seeing journalists come into conflict with powerful forces, it's because they're writing critical things. So that's the kind of, it's a kind of convoluted thinking that you have to go through to get to an optimistic place. But the one thing I will say is, you know, there are so many amazing and innovative models that are happening now. You know, and some of them are risky because you don't have, you know, massive newsrooms behind you with the institutional heft to defend journalists when they get into trouble or, you know, the kind of systems that used to exist. But the reality is there is so much. There's the kinds of transnational investigative reporting that you do, that you're doing. This is a whole new model of journalism that's really shaking up entrenched power structures. You've got, what might be called citizen journalism, or just, you know, people documenting their reality and sharing that information on Facebook, or on whatever social media platform they choose. And so these journalists are incredibly vulnerable, as a result. But the truth is, you know, there's a lot of innovative new models of journalism occurring, and there's a lot of people using the power of independent information to challenge entrenched powerful forces. And so that is something we have to recognize and celebrate.
Yeah, I think we need to also use, I always preach this, we need to use technology better as journalists. You know, we've been able to use computers to do a lot of the work that used to take us a long time to do, and then you can bring in the human brain at the end. I also think, I'm a great advocate for trans contrary journalism too, because we found when we were working on these big investigations that we're able to get stories published in certain countries that they wouldn't be able to publish themselves. So we had a situation, for instance, and I won't name the country, in one country where the journalist found a great story, they did the work, but they couldn't publish it themselves, so they gave it to us to publish, and ICIJ published. And then they had this scenario where they had to write about their, you know, us writing about something that they themselves had actually done. And we were able to get around that. We were also, in the Panama Papers, we had a scenario where two of the newspapers that we were working with in the one country, the owners of both of them were in the documents. And in one case, they did not want to publish the story. So again, we approached the newspaper and said, if you don't publish, we're going to publish. And in the end, they were forced to publish on the front page all of their dirty laundry, which, again, you have that sort of peer pressure when you're all working together, because you know that there are, you know, 106 other media organizations with that story, and it, therefore it's going to be a much bigger story if you don't publish. So, again, I think by working together, I'm a great advocate of journalists. We need to throw away the old models. We need to stop being loners. We need to stop being lone wolves. And we need to learn how, in some cases at least, how to work together. And by working together, you also get so much more context of a story, because you're getting all these different views. You know, before I started working for ICIJ, I thought, you know, I've been an investigative reporter for 20 years. I thought I knew all the tricks. I really knew nothing. And also, you know, I had a very narrow view of writing a story or presenting a story. I think now I'm much more mature about it, because I can see that there are many other viewpoints you've got to take into consideration when you're publishing a big global story. And that makes the story, when you publish it, so much better and so much deeper. And again, I think that goes to the point of where journalism kind of, we kind of forgot how to do that when the good times were rolling. And now that the bad times are rolling, I think we have to ask ourselves what's really important and how can we take that most important bit and rebuild it and rebuild the trust at the same time.
And not to dwell too much on how the sausage is made, so to speak, but I always think it's important to talk about the actual concrete steps as well and what the public is paying for, especially in this day and age when they're paying for journalism. In my public radio days, I would talk about the fact when people say, oh, you're always begging us for money and doing these membership drives and they're so god-awful. And I would say, well, you know, we need snowmobiles. And people would look at me, especially here in Southern California, and say, what are you talking about? But in fact, our radio transmitters are up on Mount Wilson. And yes, every now and then it snows to the point that if the engineers don't drive up there renting snowmobiles, because we, Lord knows, don't want to actually buy them at that cost, but that's part of what the money goes towards. And I know at any number of networks and publications, magazines, newspapers, part of what you're paying for is very serious hazard training for journalists who go off into these situations. Can you just talk a little bit briefly about what journalists today are often learning or trying to learn how to do before they deploy?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's become standard practice for journalists working in conflict zones is called hostile environment training. And it's these, like, week-long courses where often taught by ex-military, where journalists, you know, learn basic survival skills, you know, how to identify incoming and outgoing fire, how to survive a kidnapping attempt, how to take cover in a firefight, how to apply first aid. And this has become a fairly standard practice across the industry. All of my staff undergoes these courses, even though we're not actually we tend not to be working in active conflict zones. We work in areas where conflict can happen. I had somebody who was in Islamabad. I was actually in Karachi when there was a car bomb that went off, and that's just part of the nature of being deployed in these places. So that's become standard practice. There's also one thing that I definitely give credit to the industry is more recognition of how journalists experience trauma. Mm-hmm. And the support they need to recognize trauma. Trauma can occur when when you yourself are the victim of violence, but it can also occur when part of your reporting is coming into contact with people who are victims themselves. You know, our staff, part of the work we do is, you know, we're on the phone You know, sometimes meeting in person and sometimes, you know, reporting on the phone, you know, and you call someone up and you say, well, tell us about, you know, your, you know, what it was like when you were tortured, who was in the room and, you know, what did they do? Or tell, you know, somebody has just been killed and you, you know, you need, you know, as a journalist, you have to get that information. And that can really take a toll. So our organization, and I think most news organizations, recognize that you have to provide support for journalists who engage in that kind of work, and that can include peer support, but also, you know, specialized outside counseling for those who need it.
I'd like to open it up for questions. We've got a microphone, and we will come to you. And there's a couple down here. Oh, and this one will start off right back there.
I think an underlying assumption for investigative journalism is that if a story comes out and the truth of a situation comes out, changes will happen. Mm-hmm. A fear that I have is that story comes out, truth comes out, and nothing changes, either because of cynicism or political dysfunction. First, I wonder if that's an accurate assessment and if that's a concern of journalists and if that reality changes the way in which you do investigative journalism.
Yeah, happy to take that. Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I mean, one of the things we always ask ourselves before we do every story is, can we get a result from the story? Can we publicize something that is so egregious that someone, that they have to react to it? But, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I can tell you a lot of the time you do publish, nothing happens. It's very depressing. But one thing I have also learned is that a story that doesn't go away is a story you get a reaction for. And journalists often, they do the first story, they don't get a reaction, and then they move on to something else. What we've found is that if you stay with a story, if you've got a story that has a long tail to it, and you keep repeating it and you keep getting new angles for it, eventually they will start listening and eventually you will get a reaction.
Well, speaking to that, what I've noticed is basically, of course, the environment has changed. And it used to be you'd write a story and everyone, most everyone would believe it except for, say, conspiracy theorists or whatever. But now when you have Trump saying fake news and the whole world saying fake news, it's changed. It seems to me it changes the way you have to tell the story. How much are journalists studying the research that has been done as to how to psychologically move people?
Good question. I would say we've also, though, we're not taking advantage of the technology we have at the moment. I think the way to get around any accusations or fake news is to publish everything, publish the documents. You cannot tell a story in the traditional way where you would just write a piece for a newspaper and you would trust the journalist to get everything right. I think these days there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to publish every single document that, you know, allows you to come to a certain conclusion.
Understand how to form a story that it will impact people greater.
I agree totally, and I think we have to learn as journalists how to do our job better. And I think that is the first, you know, it's how we heal the current situation, is by not thinking we know everything. We have to actually get to the point where we assume we know nothing and start all over again. And that, I guess, in some ways, the nonprofit world that I'm existing in at the moment allows us to experiment in the way that the mainstream media, because they're doing things and they have to keep doing things because they're commercial, they can't afford to do it. I think the reason why the ICIJ is allowed to exist at the moment and is thriving is because they're happy for us to experiment in this space and to do things a bit differently. I agree with you.
Hi, thanks very much. I actually have a question for each of our distinguished speakers. First one is for Mr. Simon. It's about Egypt. I was just kind of hoping you would comment generally on the situation there because of all of the pressures that journalists face. You have the sentencing of Shao Kahn. You've got Mahmoud Hussein, who's still in prison there. And you had the story from last year, actually, which was that, I think it was a David Kirkpatrick story, about the government just saying, hey, all of you pundits, you need to deliver this line on the election right now. So cough it up. That's the first question. And then the second question is for Mr. Ryle, which is just on... I have two questions here, but the one I'm most curious about is on labor journalism in the business press, because at least my perception is that we don't see this that much anymore, at least in the United States here. It's very different in German papers and different in French papers and you know, more similar in British papers. But we have such a sympathetic press to management in the U.S. these days here that I'm just seeing less and less of a comment of what we used to have in the 50s and 60s and certainly in the 20s and 30s. Much of that is a product of globalization and the fact that we've seen labor move to the global south. I'd just like to comment on you to comment on how you see that strand of journalism emerging in the 21st century.
All right. Well, let me start with Egypt. Egypt is the leading jailer of journalists in the Middle East. It's the third leading jailer of journalists in the world. There's been a systematic crackdown on the media, which has essentially decimated the media. You mentioned Shao Kahn. Shao Kahn is a photojournalist who documented a massacre that took place following the 2011 elections. He was imprisoned, sentenced. He was imprisoned without charge, without trial. He was recently sentenced to 5 years in prison. He should have been released based on time served. He's still in prison. He's one of at least 17 journalists in prison. The other thing that we're seeing in Egypt, as I mentioned, they are the country that I think has most aggressively taken advantage of this fake news framework. They've actually passed new laws that criminalize the publication of false news online. And then the other dynamic that you see in Egypt, which is again sort of a global phenomena, is Sisi has forged a close personal relationship with Trump, and Egypt was deeply resistant to U.S. pressure under the Obama administration, but pressure was applied, and there's no evidence really that the Trump administration is applying any significant pressure whatsoever. So that's a point of leverage that might have curbed some of the worst abuses, which is gone. The last thing I'll mention is, Egypt, Cairo in particular, used to be a sort of global, a regional media hub. Lots of journalists who covered the region were based there. That's becoming increasingly difficult. There's less tolerance for even international reporting. There's harassment of international journalists based in Cairo. So the situation there, I'm afraid, is fairly dismal.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm not sure I've got a fantastic answer for your question about labor. I mean, I think all journalism should be about people. I think what you're seeing really is just the demise of the union movement worldwide. I think in some countries it is still very strong. But even in Australia, where it is very strong, and where I've spent most of my career reporting, the amount of time spent in that area and reporting, I mean, the beats that used to be there are no longer there. And I guess it's just a waning influence. It's the only way to, journalists tend to cover things that they think readers will come to and will be interested in. And if they feel that it's waning, then they stop covering it. And I guess it's a ongoing cycle then after that.
I know there was a time in which whistleblowers supplied a lot of information that was private. But given today's climate of the Me Too generation, in which we're encouraged to expose what's useful to be exposed, is there research on a global scale as to people contacting journalists more significant than usual?
I think we're faced with two challenges at the moment. First of all, it's getting more and more difficult for people to contact you without being caught, because if you use a phone or if you use a computer, there's likely to be a trace. And so what journalists are trying to do is make technology available for you to contact us. So if you, for instance, you go on our website, you'll see about 10 different ways that you can, you know, what we call securely contact us. But in reality, if you make certain mistakes, then at your end, before you even, you know, get onto our website to read about it, it's very difficult. I'll also say that we're in an era, we're in a golden era of information, and journalists are beginning to understand that, because people are able to copy information at a scale never thought possible before. You just think about the, you know, we've been involved in the last 5 years with the three biggest leaks in history at ICIJ. I think the last one after Panama Papers was the Paradise Papers. It was 13.5 million documents. And it's only a matter of time before that seems like a very small. You think back on WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks was about 1,000 times less than the Panama Papers. And you can see in 5 years how much that increased. So it's a dual challenge. We've got people who are able to copy information, again, on a huge scale, which is great, but you're also potentially endangering your contacts these days because the technology allows the other side to find out who you are.
Yeah, and I think Alex was asking, when you were asking about sort of safety training that newsrooms, have for their journalists who work in high risk environments, but I would even say low risk environments. But increasingly, you're seeing newsrooms that are much more aware of information security and putting in place measures to ensure that journalists are able to secure their information and are able to communicate securely with their sources. And just looking, at sort of cases around the world and instances where journalists have failed in that regard, the consequences can be terrible. So yes, I agree with Gerard. It's sort of a double-edged sword. There's, you know, all this technology is an amazing tool for both, you know, communicating and managing information, but it's also being deployed by governments to surveil and monitor journalistic communication, and that's obviously a significant threat.
And I would just add one thing on that. I think one of the challenges for journalism is educating the public on safe ways to contact us. And I don't think we're doing enough of that. And that's something we have to spend more time on.
Next question.
I would just like your take on this. I've always wanted to ask a journalist this. I think the media has created Trump, and we're pretty exhausted. Why can't the press corps someday, one day, just get up and walk out on Sarah Pinocchio Sanders? And it's just, can't we have a Trump-free day?
You want to take
that's it? Yours.
All right, that's fine. You know, I mean, I think, let me just push back against your question, because I think the premise of that question is that what happens in the White House press briefing room has some particular significance, and it's really just a kabuki theater. I mean, you know, maybe could I suggest maybe that you stop paying attention to it? Because it's ridiculous. I mean, there's no news that's made in that room.
We're not that specific.
Okay, but I mean, okay, so you know, there's so much. I mean, it does represent everything that's wrong with not just the media, but the relationship between the media and power, because everyone is sort of preening and you know, trying, you know, asking questions that, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is never going to answer, and if she does answer, it's not going to be useful. I just would sort of suggest that we contrast that sort of journalism as theater with the work that, you know, that ICIJ is doing. You know, there's a lot of journalism. I'm not sure I would agree with your premise that, you know, journalists put Trump in power, but I would concede that there was, you know, a lot of journalistic shortcomings in terms of the way he was covered, in terms of, you know, the kind of platform he was given. That's without question. But I mean, I don't think the solution, though, to you know, I understand why people are angry, but I don't think like all journalists getting together and deciding they're all going to do the same thing is actually going to be that helpful, and probably will reinforce. We saw, for example, when the Boston Globe did this amazing undertaking of reaching out to media organizations all across the country and asking them to publish editorials in support of press freedom and showing this unified front in the face of the kinds of hostile rhetoric denigrating the work of journalists and the press emanating from Trump and senior levels of his administration. You know, to the Trump supporters, that just confirmed that there was this massive collusion of all the kind of liberal media, elite media, and it was part of an organized campaign and reinforced in their own minds. So I certainly supported that effort, but I don't think that that's, you know, that even if all journalists got together and decided to boycott Trump, that would have any sort of significant consequence.
Maybe one more.
You all talked a lot about representation, specifically with women in media, and then a bit about the need for better journalism and different perspectives, and then also about trauma. So that all led me to think about other underrepresented communities, LGBTQ reporters of color, folks from low-income backgrounds. One, to think about like the different perspectives that they may share in some of these global matters, and I guess I'm thinking more specifically about U.S. reporters, but also about like any traumatic experiences that they may have encountered in their lives previous to journalism, how that may, one, either build resiliency in some of these situations that are really tough, or just maybe even more difficult for them to withstand. So I'm curious to hear from you all. I mean, are there initiatives, are there things that you've seen for some of these other underrepresented groups that allows them to tell these stories globally?
Well, I would say just they have to get more involved, and we've got to involve them more. So you've got to, just like, you know, women are better represented in journalism now, and now we're starting to see, you know, a more balanced view. So I would say the same formula.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, one of the problems or challenges that we face is, you know, the media and the way that people perceive and engage with the media is so focused on kind of the national level and national politics, and that kind of dominates coverage. And that means that community stories about people who are not necessarily participating in the kind of national political dialogue, you know, they just don't get the attention they need. And then you combine that with the fact, you know, that, you know, there's plenty of journalism happening in Washington, and probably too much, and not enough journalism happening everywhere else. So local news organizations are facing obviously tremendous financial pressure. Many have been you know, downsized. Some have disappeared. Community and immigrant. We you know, one of the things that we at CPJ do in the United States, or we've documented over time, is that immigrant media faces a very high level of risk that really is not covered in the mainstream media. You know, I mentioned the four journalists killed in the Capital Gazette. There was a fifth journalist killed in the United States. His name was Zach Stoner, and he was a blogger in Chicago who covered the hip-hop community. And he was, you know, he was an important source of information in this community. He was killed. We don't know exactly why he was killed, but there's such a high murder rate in Chicago that we really worked hard to try and get the media in Chicago engaged, to try and get the police engaged. There was really no resources put into a serious investigation. There is some evidence that he may have been killed for the reporting that he did, but the media in Chicago never really covered it. The national media never covered it. The police never looked into it, and so we don't know really why he was killed. That's unacceptable.
I can't think of a better question to end on, and I thank you for that. I'm sorry to have my back turned to you as we do it. It's the positioning of these chairs, and I'm going to take advantage of the wonderful opportunity that that question and Joel's answers afford me now to just very briefly answer the questions that Ken brought up at the beginning of this program. I, too, agree that there's been so much national reporting that both international reporting and local reporting have really suffered, which is one of a number of key reasons for me that I decided recently to join Spectrum News, which is going to be launching, and you'll be seeing and hearing a lot more about this in the weeks to come. I don't mean this is a shameless plug, although it is. I'm excited. I've never seen a newsroom like this before in my life. It looks like the Los Angeles that I know and love. It's very different. It goes to what Jared was saying as well. It's people-driven. Every story is about a person. And coming from a world where every morning I felt like I was just reading Trump headline this, Trump headline that, I get to spend an hour every evening talking about local issues. I mean, I got really jazzed the other day. We're going to do an entire hour on plastic straws and the banning of plastic. And the fact that I get to do that is a real thrill. So stay tuned for that. Well, here's the tricky part. You do talk about, and it goes to the different models of journalism. You do have to be a Spectrum subscriber, and that is the one thing about it that's very interesting coming from a background where I have to beg and plead for money. What's lovely is that they said, look, just do good journalism. We don't care about the ratings. They're not buying a news truck to go and do. There's going to be no if it bleeds, it leads. No car chases, no blood and guts. And then I said, where do I sign? So yes, you do have to be a Spectrum subscriber, although you will be able to see some of the content online as well. So if you're a Spectrum cable, I will be. I'm not allowed to. This is just a technical legal thing for my own career safety. I'm not allowed to say the number just yet, but that will be coming very soon. Let me just say that if you are a Spectrum cable subscriber, it will be hard not to see me in the very near future. So I forgive me that. I'm a radio person, so anybody who knows me personally, to see me out of yoga pants is really quite a novel thing. I want to take just another brief moment to do another shameless plug, and that one is for the library itself. To talk about a space, especially in this day and age, as both of my guests mentioned tonight, where there is so much misinformation, there is so much screaming coming at us from so many different directions, and it's often hard to get to a very honest truth. This place is a safe haven for those truths, and having events like this and so many others where anybody and everybody is welcome, and it's free, is truly a spectacular thing. So whatever you might have spent on tonight's conversation through Ticketmaster or Living Social, whatever it might be, if you want to consider that as a gift to the Library Foundation, I highly encourage you to do so. I am dearly hoping that you come back to talk about your book, because I wanted to ask you a million questions about kidnapping as well, but we'll do that next time. I believe that both Jared and Joel will be sticking around for a bit if you Absolutely. Have individual questions that haven't been answered. My thanks to the Library Foundation, my thanks to my guests, and my thanks to all of you for coming out tonight.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.